Hi, everyone. My name is Natalie Gochner. I represent the Political Center, and this is Both Sides of the Aisle. I'm so happy to be in studio with Shireen Gourbani on the left.
Hello, and hi, listeners. Thanks for tuning in.
And on the right, Mr. Ryan Wilcox.
Good morning, everyone.
Representative Ryan Wilcox. We got the legislature in the House, Shireen.
Yes.
It's always good to have someone from Capitol Hill and who puts their name on a ballot.
That's right.
So thanks for being here, Ryan. I'm going to start out by just jumping to this Justice Department action where they want to reclassify marijuana. This is the Biden administration moving to do this. They want to classify it as a lower risk substance. Shireen, I can kind of guess where you're going to come down on this, but let's hear it.
Yeah, so I think that this is a good move for a number of reasons. One is that it is currently classified with hard drugs that are, though I think we may disagree on the fundamental impact of marijuana on somebody's lives, I think that we can agree that it's different than cocaine, heroin, right? Like that the impacts are certainly different, and especially the medicinal uses are also different. So there is a huge opportunity here to improve research, to think about the way that money moves around marijuana in states that it's been legalized. And I think it does create a better structure and is a more appropriate classification of weed, which I just want listeners to know I'm not a smoker. I'm not a big weed person personally. But I do think that there are real serious significant health benefits when we're thinking about people who I've interfaced with, patients with cancer who are dealing with nausea, people who have chronic pain. There are many people who have found great comfort in weed and also people who enjoy it and generally don't hurt other people.
Yeah. Ryan, you're actually, our audience may not know this, but you're employed in the health field. So let's hear you.
Yeah. You know, I think probably the greatest value that I see in this one is really on the research side. That's been the most angst that I've had. We've passed actually some legislation here in Utah this year to try to address some of that as much as we could. But without the rescheduling, we're severely limited. We're artificially limited as most of those research dollars come out of the federal government, right? And again, this doesn't reclassify, it doesn't mean
it's
federal legalization,
yeah.
Right? But it does allow for the research that we're talking about. And there's another factor that's happened as these state laws, this sort of 10th Amendment stance that states have taken over the last several years in regards to marijuana has resulted in, and that's we have far more potent strains of this particular plant, this drug that, you know, aren't naturally occurring, that are designed that way now, genetically modified strains that we don't understand at all. We don't understand the outcomes. We don't understand the impacts.
Or the dosage.
And what that does. And there's frankly some indications that are rather concerning. So to the extent that this helps us to understand, you know, exactly what we're dealing with, I think that's a major win for everyone. And it's long overdue. So I'm glad to see it happen.
This is great. You know, watching the extremes, if we will, the right and the left come down on something in the same way. And Shireen, it sounds like Ryan knows a lot about marijuana, doesn't it?
Well, you don't have to disclose if you're a personal fan, but I'll just say that it is, I think it is something where we're seeing that opportunity for research and the benefit that it can bring to people's lives that are genuinely suffering.
Yeah.
That's important to me.
Do you think, both of you, do you think it will do anything to increase usage? That's the political middle.
Yeah.
That's my problem is I don't like it as a gateway drug.
Yeah, I can understand that. I guess I would just also say that, of course, I think a few times in the past have talked about sort of how we got to this moment around reefer madness. And when we think about the negative impacts of marijuana versus alcohol, there's a real conversation to be had.
Absolutely.
Right. So I guess I would just suggest to everyone, moderation is important. And then also, you know, if you can think about why you engage in substance use and if you need help, seek it.
Yeah. One last point on it. And Ryan, maybe you can do this. And if Shireen wants to add in, but is there any kind of political lens to put on this? Is Biden doing this because it helps him?
Absolutely. this was an option for years, right? For decades, right? And it's not like we didn't see this coming over the last several years. He's made a lot of political moves, I think, very clearly aimed towards young people in particular, whether that's what you've seen in
college debt.
Tuition and, hey, take out a loan, but you don't have to pay it back. You know, all of this kind of stuff that I think is certainly calculated. But I don't want to get lost in either the importance of reclassification or ignoring the realities of increased usage. Because I've also spent significant time, I do have two different hats, and to give context to why I've thought about this a lot, So yes, I do federal policy for Intermountain Health. But then also, I'm the chair of law enforcement and criminal justice for the state. And I see all of these different things come through mm-hmm. in both of those contexts. There are very real consequences for, and it's not necessarily harmless. I also lean a little bit libertarian in my personal political views.
There we
go. So let people do sort of what they want to do. And as long as they're not hurting other people, right? Yeah. And non-aggression principle. I sort of in line with that too. So it's very interesting. And that's why I'm so passionate about the study piece.
Yeah, yeah.
About the opportunity for us to understand what we're dealing with.
Yeah, good for our listeners to get to know Ryan better.
Yeah, it's funny how we keep getting people on the right that are lean a little libertarian on this show. Because I do,
well,
too.
You went from Dougal to me.
Yeah, but I do too. Right? And there are elements of this that I feel like actually are... I'm certainly not a full-blown libertarian, but there are elements of the libertarian lens, let's say, that I think can certainly stand to benefit people's lives.
Shireen, so we've got President Trump, a former President Trump, who is in this hush money criminal trial. And we now have the judge who has ruled, and there'll be more rules on the threatening witnesses, the gag order.
Yeah.
Fine, $9,000. Come on.
You think it should be more?
Well, I was thinking, because we know the judge has, you know, more of these coming. But yeah, I think it should be more. And I think it should be escalating. I think it should be saying, this is what it is now. You do it again, it goes to this. You do it again, it goes to this. But and I don't know what he's allowed to do.
Yeah. Well, let me just ask, because I know this case has maybe been one that you're following a little bit more closely, Natalie. But do you think this has an impact on this run for president again? Do you think there's a serious impact on Trump with this trial?
Oh, it's interesting. And Ryan, I'm curious what you think there. So I think of it from a woman's perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And let's go to the area where everyone's thinking about suburbia America and women in suburban America. I think this is terrible for the president because everything about it offends me.
Yeah.
But for the hardcore MAGA Republicans, as they're called, of course, this just, you know, strengthens them.
Right. It's an example of...
But I don't think it adds to them. So I think it hurts him overall.
Overall.
Ryan, what do you think? You buy my argument that it's the women in you know, real America that need to come to Trump if he's going to be successful and that this will offend them?
I don't know. Every political prediction I thought I knew from the last, seriously, like since before the 2016 election, I think I don't. Mm-hmm. Right? I see it after... I do think that it's largely wasted on the majority of the politically active population. They've made the decision a long time ago. This is viewed as TMZ style, like literally level of that. Even having this conversation is in that space, in their mind space for those that are going to vote for the president, former president.
Sure.
And frankly, you know, they view this as political prosecution, period.
Mm-hmm.
It's not legitimate anyway, including the women that I've spoken with in that.
Mm-hmm. In that case.
In that space, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that said, the political middle, I assume the Democrats are certainly banking on all of these things, having that kind of an effect. They're hoping that will. And they think, frankly, I need to make that case because the case for President Biden isn't very compelling.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So we have two. These are our options again?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, but I just have to highlight some recent reporting. Time Magazine has an article on Trump right now, where really the top line out of it, in fact, I believe it's the first sentence, he says what he learned in his first term was that he was too nice. And I think if we can take ourselves back to the chaos, the cruelty, the way that he spoke about people from Gold Star families to immigrants to this country, I wouldn't say being too nice was the issue, but some of the things that he outlined for his second term is he would say that he would carry out a mass deportation designed to remove more than 11 million people from the country. He said that he would build migrant detention camps and deploy U.S. military both at the border and inland. He would let red states monitor women's pregnancies and prosecute those who violate abortion bans. He would, at his personal discretion, withhold funds appropriated by Congress, according to his top advisors. And the list goes on. I mean, when we
think... Any one of those would be chilling.
Chilling, chilling.
But seeing them as a list,
that's
wow.
That's right. And I thought this one also, and I feel like, Ryan, we might agree here, but he might not come to the aid of an attacked ally in Europe or Asia if he felt that that country just simply wasn't paying enough for its own defense. I can understand being upset about that, but as a global power... That is so destabilizing. Mm-hmm. It's terrifying to think about what this could actually look like.
Ryan, you and I on the right, we actually like the idea of not having to talk about the former president. I promise you, we'll do that sometime.
That'll be awesome.
We'll skip it sometime.
My husband is a furniture maker. He's not particularly politically active, but yeah. But he bought a hat the other day that says on it, "Make lying wrong again."
Yeah.
And that's not like my political husband to do that, but that's the kind of reaction that gets in the Gawker household to this former president.
So the question I'm interested in is, was he talking about President Biden or was he talking about President Trump?
I'll tell him you said that, but yeah, he was definitely talking about
I can't quite tell
President
other than
Trump.
That there's a play on words there.
I do feel like there's a fundamental difference in character that cannot be ignored.
Between the two?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Ryan, let's stay with you for one second. What'd you think of the Fed holding on interest rates again?
This is a way longer conversation than what we have here.
Well, maybe
30 seconds.
Yeah.
30 seconds, holding on the interest rates. I think largely they like to manipulate and play God in places where they don't have any business doing it.
I think it's good for families that it's not increasing. What do you think?
I think they made the right decision, the decision they had to make. It's not helpful in the short run for the Biden administration, but it's really helpful for the country in the long run. Mm. So we'll see more of that. Hey, in our next segment, we're going to talk about the college protests occurring all around the country. So stay tuned. Natalie Gawker with Shireen Gorbani and Ryan Wilcox.
You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle on Utah Public Radio. We love to hear from listeners like you. If you would like to send us a comment, email bsotapodcast@gmail.com. That's bsotapodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening. Shireen Gorbani on the left.
Ryan Wilcox on the right.
And Natalie Gawker in the Political Center. This is Both Sides of the Aisle. I mentioned we're going to talk about college campuses and the protests. But before we do that, let's cover a couple of quick issues. First one I want to highlight is Phil Lyman's GOP lieutenant governor pick, not eligible to run in Utah, according to the election office. This is Lane Bangeter. Apparently doesn't meet the residency requirements, Ryan.
Yeah. I have a lot of friends that used to live in Utah who would really like to be the lieutenant governor that have pointed that out to me in the last couple of days.
Okay.
Right. And it's just a strange scenario to be in. And to be totally fair to the Lyman campaign, it is a little bit ambiguous the way it's written in the state constitution. The guidelines, aren't as clear as they are for some of the other offices.
Yeah. You're supposed to be a citizen of the state for 5 years preceding the election. That doesn't sound ambiguous to me.
If you live here until you're six and then you move away and then you come back at 42 and you want to be the governor.
That would be preceding the election.
Weird. Yeah,
I can understand that.
Like, I see. I'm seeing it like really preceding it, not intervening years.
Yeah.
Yeah. And in some of the other language, it specifically, requires that you're... It says immediately proceeding. And so I think, this is back to drafting. Mm-hmm. This is clearly what they meant. And that's what was interpreted by the former lieutenant governor, Greg Bell.
Shireen, this brings up a bigger issue for me. We don't have time to go into it, but I've long felt that it was a mistake to have lieutenant governor over the election office.
I think there's
a conflict there. Okay?
Oh, my goodness.
I was witnessed it firsthand because, it's a political office and it's ruling on political matters. And why not have an independent election office?
Okay.
And many other states do.
Hang on. I ran the bill this year and then negotiated. Ran into stuff. We were going to get a veto, all the things. So we agreed to hold off. So I just refiled it yesterday do that.
I come both from a perspective of watching it, but also if I were ever in that role, I would, meaning lieutenant governor, there's so many other things I'd want to spend my time on.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Well, so... can you just describe? So is it, I think I forget the exact details of other places I've lived, but a secretary of state or there's a different role that is independently elected. Is that what you're thinking statewide?
Close, but let me explain what we were going to do. So
this is a treat for our listeners. They're getting inside view here.
The secretary of state model was the first model we looked at, but of course we used to have one.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a reason why we went away from it. What we saw down in Arizona left really the same lack of confidence in a lot of the population because we have the Secretary of State and now Governor Hall that then became the governor, mm-hmm. right? And folks felt like that was a conflict of interest. You're overseeing your own election.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we had done in our draft and what we were proposing is that this would, rather than be an elected thing, it would be someone that was hired by the state independently, but that was overseen by the seven statewide elected offices. So you'd have the auditor and the treasurer, you know, and the attorney general and the governor. And of course, and then you'd have the speaker and the president that would sit there representing the two legislative branches.
I usually don't like, I like a governor, a strong governor. But in this case, I like what you're saying there because there's checks and balances
to
the statewide.
It diffuses the liability and the authority.
Makes the auditor and the treasurer
and
the AG, I guess, all be a part of like, let's make sure that this is independent and there's
so it's not
sleight of hand.
It's not ever one of the offices. And then we put it in a requirement. I think this is probably the most important
part. It doesn't
help
hearing that all of them are Republicans.
I know, I was going to say, I'm not feeling super confident given some of the behavior that we've seen out of, for example, our attorney general. But
right,
continue.
But that's, again, it's not just up to the attorney general.
Yeah, I understand.
Right?
I think that might be good. Yeah, I don't know.
You have the balance there with the court. We had a piece that the court would, you know, adjudicate any of the disputes or any of that stuff, but really the hiring decision and the oversight would be made by this panel that the people have all selected in that space to do that balance. And it provides that insulation that that we just don't have. And it doesn't mean that there's any kind of corruption. Like I said, I think I agree with the lieutenant governor's decision this week. I mean, that's clearly the intent. That's what everybody understood. That's what everybody was operating under. This is strange that we would bring somebody in that less than 4 years ago was representing Idaho, nominating Donald Trump publicly.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Right. Like that's strange.
So here's a question. You're saying it would include the Speaker of the House and the Senate leader on this.
Yeah.
Would you consider also taking the minority? Because then if you ended up in a situation where we become, and let's just go on this amazing mental journey, but let's say it's totally controlled by Democrats, you can understand why having at least two seats at that table representing the minority party might give people more faith in this idea.
Something that's nobody's mentioned that. That's actually not a bad idea.
Think about it. Here we go.
Here we go. Making policy on both sides. Yeah. Okay. One other issue I wanted to bring up. Governor Cox, he's called the affordable housing crisis an existential crisis on par with COVID, no less. So a lot of the housing research comes out of the Gardner Institute. I feel very familiar with it. It is a crisis. I don't think it's an existential crisis. I think our governor is prone to overstatement at times. Mm-hmm. I think he's incredibly smart, articulate, elegant speech. But I do think that, you know, there's a way to characterize this that isn't that.
Okay.
It reminds me of when he accused higher ed of bordering on evil for diversity statements.
Okay.
Seems like an overstatement, especially when they weren't really... They were prompts,
right?
Not requirements that you sign this as a condition of employment.
I can think of a few other examples of the inelegance we don't have to bring up at this moment. But I will say this ties into, I guess, could you just start with, do you remember off the top of your head, what is our deficit on housing right now? I remember when I was in office,
it
was about...
Yeah, it changes. Let's say it's around 35,000
35,000,
right
units. So basically saying that there's a market demand issue, right? So we've got that going. And then we also know that there has been just a huge increase in rent in Salt Lake City. That's gone up dramatically. My understanding is it's coming down a little bit.
Yeah, because there's a lot of supply about ready to hit the market.
Big time. Yeah. So that's hopefully a driver. But I noticed that the Utah Foundation, and I'm wondering if either of you can give a little descriptor. I think this is a well-respected institution in our state that really looks at big trends in kind of how people are feeling, large-scale polling, voter feedback. Their new report came out, and it's called Priced Out and Fed Up, The Cost of Living and Government Dysfunction are Voters' Top Issues in 2024. So I think...
Clever, the way they've characterized
it's
that.
Clever. Yeah, and they identified that, you know, for the first time, housing affordability was the number one concern. So I think that links up exactly and probably drove our governor's comments around
this.
Well,
I want to be clear. I mean, he's making a point that we should all pay attention to. This is a very serious problem that's not clear how we solve. So he's alerting us and trying to get, you know, laser eye focus on it. So anything you want to say there, Ryan?
Do you have any ideas about housing affordability?
Yeah,
how we increase?
You probably don't like them. But yeah.
Yeah.
The libertarian coming out here. Let's see.
So there, it's primarily supply and demand, period. We have an artificially urban zone up and down the Wasatch Front where 90% of our population lives. Expand the supply.
What does artificial urban zone mean?
Artificial because we are 67% federally owned.
Oh, I was going to. Okay. Well, that's one way of talking
about
it. Urban
zone. Interesting. See, I think of it as we have natural urban growth boundaries because of our lakes and because of our
mountains.
Yeah, we have
our
those
steep
too,
slopes. But and also our federal land. And also federal land. But but federal land is much more of an issue outside of the Wasatch Front.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Hey. College campuses. Let's talk about this philosophically. We're taping this in advance. It's a dynamic, live situation. And I'm conflicted here. Okay. I work for the University of Utah. I serve as a senior advisor to President Taylor Randall. So I'm conflicted. I'm going to just turn it to you, Shireen, or to you, Ryan, to kind of lead this conversation, and I'll pipe in as I can.
Okay. So I think I'm guessing we have agreement largely around the notion of free speech and generally support that. I also deeply support, and I think probably we all do, nonviolent protest, demonstration. I know that we have seen multiple times in recent history when for some that line is crossed quickly, right, into what is illegal, breaking the law, violating policy, what is not. I can think about the protests after the death of George Floyd, the murder of George Floyd in our own city that escalated incredibly. I'll say that for me, I guess I support the violation of policy when that policy is unjust. And navigating that conversation is much more complicated and nuanced. But sometimes I think there are issues big enough that it makes sense for us to draw attention to them in ways that feel big and dramatic. I hope that the protests and the speech allow us to focus on what is the injustice at the heart of it, rather than stoking animosity that may be existing between power structures in our community, especially when those power structures have very little to do with the institution or the greater injustice that we're fighting over. And we can get into specifics around that, but I do think that one of the great things that continues to be true in our country is that largely we are able to express our opinions, and that is important.
Yeah, for sure. What's the Capitol Hill take on this, Ryan? I know you can't speak for all. I know you can't speak for all, but you're, I mean, every legislator I know has immediate and frequent connections with their colleagues.
Yeah. Well, we hear from, well, both. We hear from constituents a lot, right? And then obviously we watch what each other is saying and doing out there. You know, essentially, you know, we view universities as centers for education for productive debate, right? That's where we should learn to have these kind of civil dialogues. I've been very concerned over the last few years, and I know several of my colleagues have, about the sort of the devolution of that concept, meaning we invite somebody to speak and then we do what we can to either prevent them from being able to speak on campus. Or we, you know, sometimes we get violent. Sometimes we have to get the police involved just to allow the speech to take place. That's the stuff that really bothers me with this. Not speaking to what specifically happened at the University of Utah, but we've been watching some of the most absurd behaviors that I've ever seen in other campuses around the country in this regard.
It's really sad.
Yeah.
So, you know, one thing that comes to my mind is, at least at the University of Utah, the issue was free speech celebrated, but you must follow the rules. And one of the rules, I mean, a hard, bright line is we don't allow structures and camping on campus without permits, without following a process. And so the decision was made to be consistent and to communicate. Shireen, you can fault that maybe there wasn't enough communication, but what I witnessed was there was absolute connection with these demonstrators to help them understand the rules. They did not want to abide by them. And somehow it feels different to me because it's one thing to protest a bad law, civil disobedience.
Yeah.
We're not talking about that here. We're talking about a camping restriction. You can't occupy a building restriction. That's different than segregation. That's different than, you know, in Gandhi's India where the, you know, England would not let them manufacture salt as Indians, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, you had to break that. That was a bad law. But we're not talking about that.
No, but I do think that there are many ways that laws, rules, policy have been designed to restrict people's right to demonstrate, right? And I also think that the way that we interact when we think about police interacting in these spaces, that de-escalation can take a number of different models. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I wish that we had a more advanced model when it comes to that notion.
Well, nobody likes a heavy police force and the look of that. I will say we're taping on graduation day. It feels so good at the University of Utah that we're going to be able to honor our graduates.
Seriously, that's what we should be talking about over
there.
Yeah,
it's awesome. And it's still, I mean, we still have graduation to come, and there'll be a lot of security and whatnot, you know, on campus. But I'm glad to have a president who has tried to find the right balance between speech and lawfulness.
Facilitate the speech as much as possible. Let's help it to be a peaceful experience for everyone so that they can learn what we need to.
And that's a wrap.
Celebrate that.
Yeah. Hey, thanks, everybody, for listening. Programs produced by Anthony Scoma. We'll see you next week.